So that's what we're asking for, is just have the debate, let the chips fall where they may.
Oh, those chips are falling. Falling all over the place.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ and in Cottage Grove on KSO. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WLRI. In Maui, Hawaii on KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN. On WLPP in Palinville, New York. In Grand Rapids, Michigan on WPRR. In New Orleans on WHIV. In Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ. Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN. Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ. Seattle, Washington's KODX. Red Bluff, Redding, California's KFOI. Round Mountain, California's KKRN. And in Minneapolis, St. Paul on AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets for your convenience. On the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR, Revolution 99, Workforce Rising, and Detour Talk, amongst other fine affiliates. Blanketing Planet Earth 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for another thrilling Bradcast as Nancy Pelosi spends what is now, I believe, her seventh hour. She's now in her seventh hour on the House floor. We'll get to that in a moment. This tweet from Sahil Kapoor from Bloomberg News says, deficits, schmeficits. Fresh off a $1.5 trillion tax cut, Congress reaches a deal to raise spending by some $300 billion over the next 2 years. He adds that post-Jimmy Carter, the U.S. budget deficit has risen under every single Republican president and has fallen under every Democratic president. That trend now appears to clearly be continuing under Donald Trump. Just keep that in mind when your friends, your relatives tell you that, Republicans are deficit hawks. Republicans are conservative when it comes to government spending.
They're the fiscally responsible ones.
That's what they love to say. It's completely and utterly untrue, and it has been untrue for decades. That was Desi Doyen, by the way. Hi, Des.
Hi.
In fact, Senate lawmakers who reached the agreement for this new spending bill on Wednesday. They agreed in the Senate on this spending bill so far, but the House, which will also have to vote on the bill, that is a different issue. Either way, it appears that the Senate deal leaves out the issue entirely of what will happen to the Dreamers, whose DACA protections from deportation by the Trump administration are set to run out as of March 5, at least in theory. Jess Hansen of the National Immigration Law Center will join us shortly to help figure out where the hell we are or aren't on that issue, that still raging battle, as millions of immigrants in the U.S. remain threatened today by Donald Trump's policies. But first, some election news, some encouraging news for those hoping for light at the end of our ongoing dark tunnel. Democrats won an ex-urban St. Louis seat in the state of Missouri's House of Representatives on Tuesday, racking up another victory in a district that was also easily carried by Donald Trump in the 2016 election. Voters in Jefferson County appeared to choose Mike Rivas, a 27-year-old Democrat, to fill a seat left vacant when the incumbent quit to run for county executive. Rivas appears to have defeated Republican David Linton by about 4 points. Now, that's a pretty good victory in and of itself, but it's even more significant when you compare it to what happened in 2016 when Donald Trump won that district by a 61-33% margin. Yes, Donald Trump won it by 28%. And now the Democrat has taken the seat by 4%. That's a 32-point swing, essentially, since the presidential election in 2016. And 4 years before that, Mitt Romney had beat President Obama in that district by 55-43 points, so by some 12 points. So this is a firmly Republican district, or at least it used to be, because Mike Rivas has now taken that that seat in the Missouri State House of Representatives. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch reports that based on the unofficial results, Republicans managed to hold on to three other seats in four special elections across the state on Tuesday. They won decisively in two western Missouri districts and narrowly in the southeast Missouri's 144th state congressional district. In all of the races, however, Democrats made substantial gains over presidential results in those same districts. And in all four, Democrats did far better than they did last time these state house seats were up for election, because the Democrats had failed to run anybody against the Republicans in those districts last time around, believed previously, I guess, by Democrats to be unwinnable for them. But what do you know? If you put someone up,
surprise,
maybe they win.
Give voters an alternative and maybe they'll actually choose
just it. Maybe they will.
What a concept.
Democrats are portraying this unexpected win on Tuesday as still more evidence that the party's voters are fired up ahead of November's midterm elections. After a string of special election wins over the course of the last year, Representative-elect Mike Rivas's victory tonight will undoubtedly send another shockwave through the GOP as we continue to run the best candidates focused on addressing local issues and improving their neighborhoods. Their neighbors' quality of life. That, according to Democratic Legislative Campaign Committee head Jessica Post in a statement on Tuesday night. Rivas is the second Democrat this year, meaning that in just the first 5 weeks of 2018, the second Democrat to win a long-held Republican seat in a state legislative race, after Democratic candidate Patty Schachner won a state Senate seat in Wisconsin just a few weeks ago, flipping another longtime Republican seat from red to blue just last month. Democrats have now picked up 35 state legislative seats across the country in special elections, while Republicans have picked up just four. That since Trump took office. 35 state legislative seats. And as you'll recall, they also picked up the U.S. Senate seat once held by Trump's Attorney General Jeff Sessions, which Senator Doug Jones won in December. So that's what's going on for Democrats so far in 2018. How are things going on the Republican side? Well, you'll recall that U.S. Senate race I mentioned in December, won by Democrats, was against the controversial Roy Moore, candidate, former Alabama Supreme Court justice who had been accused of sexual misconduct by a number of women, including some who say that he molested them as teenagers. That's who Republicans put up for the U.S. Senate last year. So how are things looking for midterm races beginning to fill out now across the country for Republicans this year? Well, Fonzie actually pointed this one out to me via Twitter over the weekend.
Not the real Fonzie.
Yes, that Fonzie. Henry Winkler.
Seriously?
Yeah, well, he tweeted that if this is true, he said, "Oh my parents escaped from Nazi Germany to live free and taught me this can never happen again." He was citing a tweet from Jeff Yang of CNN, who said, and here we are, folks, former head of the American Nazi Party, Arthur Jones, unrepentant white supremacist and Holocaust denier, will be the GOP nominee for the U.S. House of Representatives for Congress in Illinois' 3rd Congressional District. He said, an actual Nazi is now a GOP candidate, and party line GOP voters will vote for him. Arthur Jones, according to the Chicago Sun-Times, an outspoken Holocaust denier, activist, anti-Semite, and white supremacist, is poised to become the Republican nominee for an Illinois congressional seat representing parts of Chicago and nearby suburbs. Jones told the Sun-Times, quote, "Well, first of all, I'm running for Congress, not the Chancellor of Germany, all right? To me, the Holocaust is what I said it is. It's an international extortion racket." Indeed, Jones's own website for his latest congressional run as a Republican includes a section titled "The Holocaust Racket," where he calls the genocide carried out by the German Nazi regime and collaborators in other nations to be, quote, "the biggest, blackest lie in history." From the 1990s to 2016, Jones, a 70-year-old retired insurance agent, has jumped into the Illinois GOP's 3rd Congressional District primary 7 different times, but he never came close to becoming a viable contender. But that outcome will be different for Jones in the Illinois primary on March 20. To his own amazement, he apparently is the only Republican on the ballot.
Wow.
The GOP did not bother to put anybody else up. He said, "And given the fact that I've got no opposition in the primary, okay, I win that one by default, all right," Jones said during an interview. "That leaves Illinois Republicans saddled with a nominee who is well known for racist and white supremacist activities and does not try to hide it like so many of them do."
He says the parts he's not supposed to say out loud.
Yes.
He says them out loud.
Yes, he says, "I am, yes, an actual
wow.
Nazi." Jones told the Sun-Times he's a former leader of the American Nazi Party. He now heads a group called the America First Committee, which is an organization with membership open to any white American citizen of European non-Jewish descent, he says.
Wow.
America First. Sound familiar? That is, of course, the longtime slogan used by racists here in the U.S. going back for decades, and now, of course, used by Donald Trump in his own policies and his own rallies. The Anti-Defamation League has been keeping tabs on this Jones guy for years. In November, he will face either Congressman Dan Lipinski, Democrat from Illinois, or Lipinski's Democratic primary challenger, Marie Newman, in what is a heavily Democratic district that is about to become a great deal more so, I suspect, or maybe at least I hope. Last spring in Pikeville, Kentucky, Jones spoke to a National Socialist Movement gathering. That would be the neo-Nazis. He said in his address, according to a video on YouTube, that he was sorry that he voted for Donald Trump, who has, quote, "surrounded himself with hordes of Jews," including his Jewish son-in-law, Jared Kushner.
Wow. Okay, Illinois voters. Good time to step up.
Yeah, you think? Speaking of stepping up against this this nativist...
This resurgence of nativists, my goodness.
In this country, on Wednesday, the Senate leaders from both parties, as I mentioned, announced an agreement for a 2-year, almost $400 billion budget deal that would provide Pentagon and domestic programs with huge spending increases. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell announced the pact along with the top Senate Democrat, Chuck Schumer, and said it will contain almost $300 billion in spending over current limits on defense and domestic accounts. The measure is said to also contain some $90 billion in overdue disaster aid and an increase in government borrowing cap, that disaster aid for Texas, Florida, Puerto Rico, etc. It will also, as I said, increase the government borrowing cap that would prevent a first-ever U.S. government default on its obligations. In other words, it's going to lift the debt ceiling as well if this thing passes. They're going to put this into the government funding. Now, that is reasonable and wise. However, you may recall that Tea Party conservatives have virulently objected to raising the debt ceiling. over and over again, at least when Obama was the president of the United States, when there was a Democrat in the White House. And the need to lift this debt ceiling now has come much sooner than previously expected due to the GOP tax legislation, which has already lowered incoming revenue to the government needed to pay our bills. But opposition to the Senate deal was mounting on Wednesday in the U.S. House, where so-called conservative Republicans, if we can still call them that, and progressive Democrats are reportedly none too happy with the deal made in the U.S. Senate. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi said on Wednesday that she and a large number, whatever that means, quote, a large number of fellow Democrats will oppose the spending deal to keep the government open unless she is guaranteed a vote on immigration legislation. She's not demanding a fix for DACA. She's just saying, hey, guarantee us a vote here in the House the way you guaranteed, the way Mitch McConnell guaranteed or at least promised a vote on immigration issues over in the U.S. Senate. To underscore her concerns, Pelosi spoke for more than 7 hours on the House floor on Wednesday. She is actually still speaking as we go to air. Don't know how long she's going to go, but she has been speaking to demand this guarantee for such a vote in the House from Speaker Paul Ryan.
I am hopeful that we can get that commitment. And let me say about this House of Representatives, with the people's house, and the wisdom of our founders elected every 2 years to have us constantly accountable to our constituents. Let's have the debate on the floor. So that's what we're asking for. It's just simply a vote. No guarantee. Have the debate. Let the chips fall where they may.
So her voice was beginning to give out a little bit there. I think, Desi, you said that was in
hour... That was the fifth hour.
Hour five.
Yeah.
According to the House historian, while lengthy speeches, you know, sort of filibusters are more common, of course, in the U.S. Senate, Pelosi's speech is now the longest on the record on the House floor by far. I think previously, so 7 hours as of now, previously the record was held by John Boehner back in, I want to say, 2010, when he spoke for a little bit more than 1 hour. And do you know what he was trying to highlight at the time?
I don't recall.
He was trying to block the cap and trade bill in the in the House, which was passed at the time by Democrats. Boehner was in the minority at the time. He became House Speaker, but he was in the minority at the time. It was passed in the U.S. Senate.
In the House.
I'm sorry, in the House, but then it was blocked.
In the Senate.
In the Senate.
By Democrats.
Democrats, yeah.
Because they didn't want to lose. They were worried about having that debate and letting those chips fall where they may.
So Pelosi's speech now, longest on the record in the House floor, where she was able to, usually in the House, debate is greatly limited. But Pelosi exploited a bit of a loophole here that allows for party leaders to speak as long as they like. And she has been sharing statements from DACA recipients about
sharing
themselves.
Some very heartbreaking stories that she's sharing. Not just heartbreaking, but also uplifting and inspiring of these DACA kids who were brought by their parents into this country.
Yep.
And how they have made great strides in their lives and are contributing to the economy and really are the kinds of people that we would like to have as American citizens.
I'm glad to see her highlighting that. Whether that will satisfy many progressives, Democrats, immigration advocates who were very angry a couple of weeks ago when Democrats caved in their demand for DACA legislation along with that short-term government spending bill. Whether that is going to satisfy those folks, well, that remains to be seen. It's unlikely that Democrats on their own will be able to stop this bill if it passes in the Senate from being able to keep it from passing in the U.S. House. But if a whole bunch of Democrats say no, along with a number of these Tea Party, what do they call them? Freedom Caucus now. Freedom Caucus Republicans, then this thing may not pass in the House. We don't know. The current Senate deal comes without a fix for Dreamers, those thousands, hundreds of thousands of immigrant children who came to the country years ago with their parents. It's not clear as of this hour how many of those Democrats are going to follow Pelosi's lead, but her actions on Wednesday now have raised new uncertainty, because we need that, new uncertainty about whether congressional leaders will be able to finalize a deal as planned. But it has served to highlight the ongoing anxiety and turmoil for millions in this country right now, living every day with constant uncertainty over their fate. You know, you always hear from Republicans about, we need a tax cut because Americans and American businesses, need to have certainty about their future so they can plan. Well, imagine what it's like right now to be one of these dreamers in this country. Jess Hansen of the National Immigration Law Center joins us next to discuss where we may or may not be going from here, and if the law will even allow the mass deportation that could begin as early as March 5, unless there is some sort of fix to DACA. I'm Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast. All right, welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. It looks like Senate Democrats and Republicans have made a deal for a spending bill to keep the government open after its Thursday night, Friday morning deadline for running out of money, and they are set to increase both military and domestic spending by somewhere between $300 and $400 billion, because, as you know, deficit spending doesn't actually matter to Republicans when they are running the government. That increase comes on top of the $1.5 trillion that they voted to add to the national debt with their recent tax cut bill. But despite the Democrats' willingness to shut down the government about 3 weeks ago due to the GOP and Trump White House unwillingness to strike a deal to protect hundreds of thousands of so-called dreamers who were previously protected from deportation under the Obama-era DACA program, the latest agreement in the Senate to avoid another government shutdown appears to include no agreement at all on immigration issues. That, despite a Trump-imposed March 5 deadline after which the administration could begin mass deportations of the Dreamers if legislation is not passed to fix the DACA issue. That is a problem that Trump created on his own when he reversed Obama's program last September and lifted protections for some 800,000 children of immigrants who came here illegally, many of them decades ago. Adding to the quagmire are the many new anti-immigration demands that the Trump White House has now added to their negotiation offers. Some might say bad faith negotiation offers in exchange for new DACA protections. And complicating the matter still further, or at least adding another layer of uncertainty and confusion to the entire issue, is the fact that a federal court in California has found Trump's reversal of Obama's DACA program to have been done unlawfully, meaning the March 5 date is either a deadline or it isn't. Trump's anti-immigrant chief of staff, John Kelly, told reporters on Tuesday that DACA recipients are, quote, not a priority for deportation if Congress allows their protections to expire before March 5. But as Alice Holstein at TPM noted, that is cold comfort for dreamers like Juan Escalante, who works for the immigration advocacy group America's Voice. He told TPM that it's a black hole in the calendar. People will lose their jobs, lose their privileges to drive as of March 5. One of the main things I'm wrestling with, he says, is the psychological effect that this is having. Everyone is fearful. I can't plan for my future. For people to be under that stress, it really does break you down emotionally. I can only imagine. With the stress that all of us are going through right now, thanks to this administration, I can't even imagine what those facing the threat of imminent deportation to some country that many of them have never known at all after coming here as children with their parents and living here their whole lives, I can't even imagine what they must be going through each day now. Escalante says that ICE has a database of every single person in the DACA program, where we live, our fingerprints. It's way more information than they have on the average undocumented immigrant, he said. So on March 6, if I go to the media and speak out in defense of myself, are they going to come after me? Escalante pointed to the case of Daniela Vargas, who we spoke about on this show some weeks ago. She's a DACA recipient who came to the U.S. at the age of 11, who was arrested and turned over to Homeland Security after daring to speak out at a press conference criticizing the Trump administration's immigration policies. That young woman in Mississippi spoke out against her father and brother being detained, and ICE came back to retaliate against her, Escalante says. They tried to deport her. They took her into custody, and if it hadn't been for the outcry from the community, she would have been deported, even though she was eligible for a DACA renewal. So he says, it's all fine and dandy for General Kelly, Trump's chief of staff, to say we're not a priority, but the evidence points to this being where we are headed. GOP Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has promised there would be a vote on these issues in the U.S. Senate if they were not resolved before a new government spending bill was passed. That debate and vote is now said to be scheduled for next week in the U.S. Senate. But even if McConnell keeps his word, which is never guaranteed, there is also no guarantee that a bill can even pass the Senate, even if they do have a debate. And no guarantee it can even pass the more radical far-right House of Representatives or even be signed by this president, who has now added demands not only for money for his southern border wall to his deal offer, which you'll remember Mexico, not the U.S. taxpayer, was supposed to pay for that wall, but he's also added radical new restrictions on legal immigration as well to those demands. So where does all of this leave us? And in particular, where does it leave the hundreds of thousands now facing imminent deportation as soon as March 5? Joining us to try and figure that out is Jess Hansen. She's an immigration law attorney and Skadden Fellow with the National Immigration Law Center here in Los Angeles. The NILC's mission, according to their website, is to defend and advance the rights and opportunities of low-income immigrants and their family members. Jess Hansen, welcome back to the broadcast.
Thanks for having me back.
Sure. Since you're an immigration attorney, Jess, let's start with the legal issues here. There seems to be a lot of uncertainty about whether DACA was lawfully reversed at all by Donald Trump. A federal judge some weeks ago ordered that the administration must continue to take new DACA registrations. The law was at least partially blocked by that judge. Does that mean the Trump administration is now barred from deporting Dreamers as of March 5, as you understand it?
Well, in that case, on January 9th, as you mentioned, the judge in the Northern District of California case, of which there are several cases challenging the termination of the DACA program, Milk is litigating one of those cases in New York. But in the California case, the judge there issued what is called a preliminary injunction, basically a temporary block on the Trump administration from ending the DACA program. But as you mentioned, it's not a complete block. It only allows certain parts of the program to go forward. Mm-hmm. So, for example, as of right now, the Trump administration is mandated to allow individuals who have had DACA previously to renew their DACA grant. So people who may have already expired, but they did have DACA in the past, are able to renew now. And the agency that accepts those applications, which is USCIS, is currently processing those applications. So for a lot of people who were already part of the DACA program, this is a temporary reprieve. If they're able to get in their renewal applications as soon as possible and have those processed, they could potentially get an additional 2 years of work permit and DACA grant under this current order.
Uh-huh.
However, that order has been appealed both to the Ninth Circuit, and also the government took the unusual step of seeking to skip review of the Ninth Circuit and instead appealed directly to the Supreme Court through a very rare legal mechanism called cert before judgment.
Mm-hmm.
So the government filed its request with the Supreme Court on January 18th. Both sides have already briefed the Supreme Court, and we are expecting the Supreme Court to announce whether it is going to hear that case or not on February 16th. So we're still waiting to see what happens with that. But meanwhile, the government has not asked, the plaintiffs in that case have not asked that the program be blocked while this is happening. So that means that while the appeal is happening, people can still apply to renew. And so we are recommending that folks who have had DACA in the past, even if it had expired, to go ahead and renew. We have a lot of information and resources on our website, NILC.org, to help people figure that out, because under the previous iteration of this, there were a lot of people who maybe had one tiny mistake in their application, and their entire application was rejected for that reason.
Mm.
So instead of just rushing to the mailbox, we do have some tips for folks to make sure that they're, you know, crossing all their T's and dotting all their I's before sending that out. But to answer your question, as of right now, folks can apply to renew, but that order in the California case does not apply to people who have never before had DACA.
Mm.
So, for example, if someone since the program was terminated has now aged in, has now become old enough to apply, so they've been there their whole life and they just turned 15, they cannot apply for the first time because the order doesn't cover them. So in our case in New York, which is Bataya Vidal versus Nielsen, we also had recently had oral argument on our similar request to our judge for a preliminary injunction, but our request is broader. We would like for the judge in our case to order the government to also accept initial applications. And so we are just waiting to hear from our judge in that case. He has not ruled on it yet. And there are several other cases moving forward as well. So we just have to keep monitoring whether, you know, more folks might be able to apply during this time while we wait for Congress.
So if nothing happens, if nothing changes in Congress, if nothing changes in the courts for the moment, that would mean that those people who do apply for renewal, if they're accepted, they'll be protected in theory for the next 2 years. But those who never applied in the first place, or as Trump's chief of staff, John Kelly, said, who were, quote, too lazy to get off their asses. Those people, I was going to say as of March 5, but I guess as of right now, they are eligible for immediate deportation by this administration. Do I understand that correctly?
That's correct. And to respond to your comment about General Kelly's remarks, those remarks reflect an ongoing deep white nativist sentiment with this administration that has shown itself over and over and over again. And it's just entirely inappropriate that narrative is being inserted into this really urgent situation where we really need a fix from Congress. Because as you mentioned, this the temporary relief that we're achieving through the courts is temporary, and as you mentioned, it doesn't cover everyone who is eligible for DACA. And so we really need Congress to pass a narrow bipartisan bill that only focuses on relief for Dreamers and doesn't include all the other more extremist immigration policies that the Trump administration, including General Kelly, are advocating for.
And I want to talk about some of those in a second, but since we got to Kelly here, as I noted at the top, Kelly also said that while DACA recipients are, quote, not a priority for deportation if Congress fails to act, he says that he doubts very much that Trump would extend the program if a deal is not struck before March 5, adding that he's, quote, not so sure this president has the authority to extend it. Does the president have the authority to extend it if he wants to?
That is actually a more complicated question than it would first appear. Advocates have always argued that the president did have the authority to create the DACA program. The Trump administration and the government in the litigation has taken the position that it was never lawful for the government to start this program in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
We don't agree with that, obviously, and we're challenging that, but the position that government has taken in litigation is that they couldn't. So, you know, in the litigation, we have pointed to Trump's consistent changing of his narrative of whether he can or cannot continue a program like this,
mm-hmm.
to point out that we truly believe and we hope to prove through these lawsuits that the motivation for ending the DACA program was based on improvident factors. It was not based on facts. It was not based on needs for policy or changed circumstances. It was entirely based on animus toward immigrants, toward Mexicans in particular, and Trump's consistent changing really sheds light on that.
Is that the basis on which the judge out here in California actually blocked at least parts of Trump's executive order, that it was based on animus, there was no actual need for it, or was it something else out in California that led the judge to that finding?
The ruling in the California case, while the plaintiffs in that case did bring an equal protection animus claim,
mm-hmm.
the actual preliminary injunction was based on the Administrative Procedure Act, and finding that, based on a preliminary finding, again, this is temporary until the judge has a chance to hear the merits of the entire case,
mm-hmm.
but the preliminary injunction is based on a finding that the plaintiffs are likely to succeed in showing that the decision to end DACA was arbitrary and capricious. So that's, it's different than animus, but it's related in that we are arguing similarly that it was entirely arbitrary. There was no rational reason for this action to take place.
Doesn't the government, the president of the United States, have pretty much the right to do anything he wants, essentially, when it comes to immigration law? At least that's the argument that the Republicans have made, and to some extent, it's sort of backed up by the actions that Barack Obama took in implementing DACA in the first place. Does that right not exist, going both ways for presidents?
It exists both ways if certain procedures are followed,
mm-hmm.
and the reasoning behind those actions has to have some basis in fact or policy. So first of all, when President Obama implemented the DACA program, he decided, based on a lot of research, of lengthy memos, a lot of statistical evidence, that the individuals who would be benefiting from this program have lived in the United States most of their lives,
mm-hmm.
And would be screened appropriately to ensure that they merited, or, you know, in some cases didn't merit, a favorable exercise of prosecutorial discretion,
mm-hmm.
And that is DACA. And so by Trump, by unilaterally reversing all of those findings,
mm-hmm.
all of those statistics without any reason,
mm-hmm.
any new facts at all, it is arbitrary and capricious for him to do that. And a president, even a president, is not above the law. If there needs to be some sort of rational reason for a presidential action, especially when it is blanket affecting, you know, hundreds of thousands of individuals, it needs to be measured and it needs to have it needs to be supported by facts.
Since the Democrats appear to have blinked a few weeks ago during the initial government shutdown, when they had promised that they would not agree to funding the government unless there was a deal on DACA. Since then, Trump has now seemingly moved the goalposts on what he had originally called for, which was a clean DACA bill in exchange for some new border security funding. Now he's added not only a demand for $25 billion for a border wall, he also wants to restrictions on legal immigration, on the visa lottery program, and on the family reunification program, which he and many Republicans refer to derisively as chain migration. Can you explain what those two programs are, the visa lottery and chain migration, and how they're both being misrepresented by Trump? He said during his State of the Union address last week that the visa lottery essentially allows anyone from anywhere in the world to come into the country without respect to their skills or without background checks. He said that the so-called chain migration allows an unlimited number of family members to be brought over, essentially by anyone who is given a green card. Can you respond to those two points, Jess Hansen?
Sure. First of all, the Diversity Lottery is a visa program that is meant to encourage individuals from underrepresented countries to migrate to the U.S. It is completely random, although folks who are eligible to be in the lottery are screened intensively before they can, you know, come into the U.S. on that. And that usually, typically, folks that come in on the Diversity Lottery are from the continent of Africa, for example, where there are not as many immigrants from Africa as there are, for example, from Central America, mm-hmm. South America. And so the Diversity Lottery truly is what it says. It helps to diversify the group of immigrants that are coming into the U.S.
And just to underscore what you said, there is an extensive background check on those people. It's not like, and many of them, I understand, wait like a decade or so to...
Yep.
To get in on that. So it is not as Trump, surprise, surprise, it is not as Trump has been representing it, that program.
That's correct. And the president has been completely misrepresenting these programs. Again, there is very strong racial undertones to everything he's saying about these programs, because the things he's trying to portray are, he's stoking nativist fears. He's not explaining facts in these cases. And so to move on to so-called chain migration, mm-hmm. which we prefer to call family reunification, first of all, it is not true that anyone can basically petition for any family member to come in. There are strict rules on which family members a person can ask for, depending on how old that person is and whether that person is single or married. And as you mentioned earlier, it takes up to 20-25 years for someone to be in the right place in line, mm-hmm. to even be eligible for a visa through that program after intensive screening. And so these programs are already not doing enough to help families be reunified and to diversify immigrants that we are having in the United States, and yet Trump wants to end them because he's completely misrepresenting what they're doing. And as I mentioned before, these are nativist policies that Trump is trying to make America white again, basically. Mm. That's what is going on here. And it's a really lopsided, very lopsided plan, the so-called four-point plan of this administration, because one of the points is a fix for DACA, but all three of the other points are just really anti-immigrant, with a lot of racist undertones, and we definitely do not support those policies.
It also seems ill-considered, because the fact is, as I understand it, we need immigration. We need immigrants. We need to actually increase the population as the baby boomers are retiring and so forth. Someone needs to be able to pay their bills for, you know, Social Security, Medicare, and so forth. And to that end, we need to increase the population, and that's where immigration comes in. And when we cut off immigration like this, it seems like we're severely hurting ourselves just on a numbers basis, down the line. But Jess, I want to ask you, I know you're not a politician, you're an attorney, but that means you also know how negotiations work. Did the Democrats... did they blow it by backing down from their insistence that a DACA bill must be passed before they agreed to funding the government a couple of weeks ago during that shutdown? You know how negotiations work. Did they give away their leverage by indicating that, they were just largely bluffing, as you see it?
It's really hard to say. We're definitely going to have to wait for next week to see if Senator McConnell stays true to his word, because if he does, then the compromise that was made will hopefully come to fruition. But we're still in kind of a wait and see mode. It is inexcusable that the Senate leadership has agreed to put immigrant youth aside in the current deal that they have reached. And we'll have to see what happens with that as well. It still has to go through the House. And so if congressmen and women in the House decide not to support that bill unless it does include protections for Dreamers, that could be another route. But it's really difficult to say. We're just going to have to keep stressing that we really need a narrow fix for DACA recipients that does not include these other anti-immigrant proposals.
I got just another couple of minutes here, but I want to ask you 2 points. One about the parents of these DACA kids. Obama had tried to offer some sort of protection for them as well, but he was blocked, as I understand it, by the courts. have any of the conversations that you've heard about an immigration deal or what may or may not come up for a vote in the Senate next week, have any of those conversations included talk about protection from deportation for the parents of the Dreamers? In the event that these DACA kids are allowed to stay, the deportation is put off, what of their parents that brought them here? Any conversation you have heard about that in any of these negotiations?
Unfortunately not. That is not part of the conversation right now. And that shines a light on an even bigger problem is, what about the 12 million undocumented immigrants that already live in this country and are part of our communities? There are coworkers, there are doctors, they're in every aspect of our communities, and the policy proposals, other than a fix for DACA, the policy proposals that the Trump administration has put forward do nothing to address the issues of folks who are already living here and who, the majority of whom, who have lived in the United States for many, many years and really have established their lives here. Their roots are here. Their kids are here. They're a part of the United States. As you said earlier, immigrants are an integral part of this country, and the current, grandstanding that's happening in Congress is really doing nothing to address the plight of those individuals, including parents of DACA recipients. And so that's another battle we have to keep fighting because those individuals are still not being discussed in earnest.
In recent days, we've reported on some of the terrible stories of ICE essentially scooping up, detaining, deporting folks who were told that they could remain here, who haven't committed crimes, some not even being allowed to say goodbye to their families before they were detained, families being torn apart. Are the stories that are, of the detentions and the deportations that are going on right now, even as we speak, are those adequately being reported by the corporate media, who is often tied up into the politics of Trump and congressional politics and everything else? Are those stories adequately being told as you see it by the corporate media, or are they, is the mainstream media falling down on the job?
I do think the mainstream media could do a lot more to lift up these stories because a lot of people don't realize it's happening. If you don't know someone who knows someone who went through that, or if you're not paying really close attention to your local news or however that information is being communicated, a lot of people have no idea that this is going on, and the people who don't know that it's going on might be the biggest voices in opposing it. And as we've seen in the past, ICE and CBP, the two immigration enforcement agencies, are very sensitive to critical media feedback. And so, for example, in Danny Vargas's case, she's actually NILC's client. Mm-hmm. Part of why the government released her was because there was so much outcry over the fact that she was arrested. And so I do think it's important when these arrests are happening, which they are, unfortunately, and especially in retaliation for people speaking out or taking other public stances, I think the public and the media really does need to step up and really, really denounce these types of arrests and detentions in order for ICE to stop doing it.
Jess Hansen, attorney at the National Immigration Law Center, or NILC. You can find their work at NILC.org, on the Twitters at NILC_org. And you can find Jess herself, if you like, on the Twitters at Jess, HNSN. Jess Hansen, always great and incredibly informative talking to you. I suspect we'll be doing it again in the days ahead as this mess continues. Thanks for joining us today, Jess.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. Okay, a quick break, and we are back with, Desi Doyen. You'll like this story.
Oh, good.
No Green News Report coming up after this, but a little bit of science. Science and elections.
I do like that.
Stand by for that. I'm Brad Friedman. This is The Bradcast.
Science.
Yes. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com, where usually Desi Doyen is blinding us with science. But no, I'll do the honors here in a moment. I just want to say over the break, got word that Nancy Pelosi has ended her talkathon in the U.S. House after more than 8 hours of trying to bring attention to the plight of the Dreamers. As the over in the Senate, as Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell believe they have a deal that will dramatically raise spending both for military and domestic issues by some $300 billion. That has ticked off so-called conservative Republicans, and they are joining the progressive Democrats in the U.S. House, who are ticked off that the bill says nothing at all to about Dreamers to protect them. So we will see what happens. The Senate is poised to pass this thing, I think, on Thursday. Then they send it back to the U.S. House. We'll see if it can pass or if we are headed towards another government shutdown at midnight on Thursday. But before we get there, more than 60 researchers and technologists are running for federal office in 2018 as part of a historic wave of candidates with science backgrounds who are launching campaigns. At least 200 candidates, 200 with previous careers in science, technology, engineering, and math, announced bids for some of the nation's roughly 7,000 state legislative seats as of January 31, 200 of them.
Wow.
That, according to data that 314 Action, a political action committee, shared with Huffington Post, the group, which launched in 2014 to help scientists run for office, said it is talking with 500 more people and is pressing about half of them to run. An additional 200 such candidates are running for school boards.
Oh, good.
Right?
Yeah, that's very important.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, not only because locally they set the standards and they choose the textbooks, especially at the state level, they mm-hmm. choose the textbooks, but these people set all kinds of policies that affect students directly in every school in America.
314 Action founder Shaughnessy Naughton told the Huffington Post that the number is really astonishing. We've never seen anything like this, he says. This is the largest number of scientists to run for public office in modern history. And it should be noted here that if any of them win in their runs for Congress, that it would dramatically multiply the number of scientists in Congress beyond the current. Do you know how many scientists there are currently?
I know it's not very many.
No, it is not. It is one.
Well, there you go.
Congressman Bill Foster of Illinois, Democrat from Illinois. He's the lone PhD scientist in Congress. He's a physicist. The surge in congressional bids, of course, comes as scientists are expecting a fierce political backlash against Donald Trump, who has yet to name a science advisor. He's been in there for, what, more than a year now. Hasn't named a science advisor because he knows all the science he needs to. He gets his science advisor as Fox News. And, of course, he has proposed dramatically slashing research budgets across federal agencies. He openly mocks the widely accepted science behind global warming. He appointed Scott Pruitt, the EPA administrator, who has reversed regulations to reduce greenhouse gases, put new rules in place to give control of agencies' science advisory boards to researchers who are paid by the industry instead. The so-called war on science is being waged in Congress as well, under not just in the White House, under the leadership of Congressman Lamar Smith of Texas. He's leaving, isn't he?
He's retiring.
He's stepping down?
Yes,
yeah, good.
Finally.
Good riddance. See you later, Lamar. Under his leadership in the House Science Committee, he's a climate change denier. He's a fossil fuel ally. He has mounted repeated witch hunts to actually attack scientists themselves.
Yeah, to investigate them.
Leading some to call it the House Anti-Science Panel. The attacks on science, of course, did not start with the Trump administration, Naughton notes, but it has been a catalyst to getting scientists out of the lab and into running for federal office. He says that is one bright spot.
Oh, that's a hugely bright spot. And this comes at the expense of their careers as a scientist, you know, publish or perish. They actually need to continuously publish research. This is taking them out of that in order to step up to protect science for the rest of us.
Publish, perish, or run for office.
I like
which
it.
Is what they seem to be doing. One of them, a number of the folks who have been endorsed by 314 Action include someone by the name of Sunil Gupta, a systems architect and former executive at Mozilla and Groupon. He's running for Michigan's 11th district seat to replace Congressman David Trott, the Republican attorney nicknamed the Foreclosure King because he used to own one of the state's largest foreclosure mills, law firms. Trott, who is another one of these guys who is not running for election again. He has a 4% lifetime League of Conservation voters score. And this huge bunch of Republicans who are running to succeed him don't seem to be improving on that. At a recent Republican debate held last month, all six of those candidates answered no when they were asked 55 minutes into the debate if they believed in, quote, man-made climate change. They all said no. So let's put a scientist in instead, shall we, Michigan? We'll hopefully cover more on that story as the year progresses, but these primaries are coming up right now, in just weeks from now. So pay attention. All right. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to my guest today, Jess Hansen of the National Immigration Law Center, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It is, as ever, appreciated. If you missed any portion of today's show, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. But please do consider while you're there stopping by bradblog.com/donate. My thanks to those of you who have done so. You help keep us on your public airwaves and on your podcasts and everywhere else at bradblog.com/donate. We rely on you. Thank you in advance. You can drop me an email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the Facebooks and the Twitters, I am simply The Brad Blog. That is it. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. You're not. Good luck, world.